Thanks, Chair. Just the next one then is Child Justice Amendment Bill. It's a Section 76, sorry, 75 bill, which means it's a party vote in the NCOC, not a provincial vote. You can't amend it, you can only recommend amendments to the National Assembly. The National Assembly can overrule you. You would know in the case of Section 76 bills, if there's a dispute between, if the National Assembly doesn't agree with your amendments to the traditional courts bill, that it has to go to mediation, whereas you can be overruled. Now, this one, I'll start, unless Thandis Kosana will sort of go through the thing clause by clause. Effectively, what this bill is about is the age of criminal capacity for children. And criminal capacity is the age at which you can understand that you've done right or wrong. South Africa used to be at 7, so a child of 7 and older had criminal capacity. When the Child Justice Act was passed, it was moved up to 10. In other parts of the world, criminal capacity can go as high as 18, 16, 18, 14. Ultimately, I think we should be looking at probably 14, but I'll explain why we haven't gone there yet. When we dealt with the Child Justice Bill or Act, it was, we'll move it up 3 years, but there was a provision in the bill that the minister must do a report on the issue to Parliament. And in terms of that, that report was done, and there was a recommendation that from the people doing that investigation, that the age of criminal capacity be moved up from 10 to 12. What the bill provides for is a further review after 5 years to see whether it shouldn't move to 14. What we are scared of doing is if the child doesn't have criminal capacity, then they're not just like free to go. I mean, children can do terrible things, murder, rape even, under even 11-year-olds. But the idea would, the issue is a child who doesn't have criminal capacity gets dealt with by the children's court, social development, social workers, etc. So what the bill basically provides for is moving the age of criminal capacity from 10 to 12. Between 12 and 14, there's what's called a rebuttable presumption that the child does not have criminal capacity. In other words, the state has to prove that the child has criminal capacity in the case. Currently, that rebuttable presumption is from 10 to 14, so it will just be keeping it from the 12 to 14 age. The other major change was that currently, if a child is to be diverted, the magistrate has to convince themselves that the child has criminal capacity. And we've changed that to make it easier to say that the magistrate can send the child on the diversion program if the magistrate believes, or I think the prosecution believes, that the child will benefit from that program. That's also sort of to make life easier. Ms. Kosana will go through the bill clause by clause. Maybe just to say, when it came to the National Assembly, as far as I recall, the bill was passed unanimously. This bill then was, we were hoping it would be passed by the end of the administration. I think, unfortunately, your former secretary is not here, but I think it was advertised in the previous, Mr. Michalakis was there, I don't know who else was there. But it's I don't know if there were public comments, but you'd also need to allow public input. But yeah, if I can add to Ms. Kosana.
Amend Section 7 of the Act to give effect to the recommendations of the report, and it increases the minimum criminal capacity from 10 years to 12 years. And the amendment to Section 7 of the Act necessitated special amendments in various sections of the Act that were called in order to substitute the reference to a child under the age of 10 years and substitute that and refer to a child under the age of 12 years. So these amendments, these constitutional amendments, are contained in the number of clauses that are indicated there, clause 2 up to clause 24 of the bill. The clauses that deal with the proof of criminal capacity for the purposes of diversion was informed by two issues that were the findings of the report that the Deputy Minister is referring to. And those issues are that, one, there were unintended consequences in the implementation of the rebuttable presumption. And the report found that since the Act commenced, many magistrates are uncertain as to whether they may still decide on the criminal capacity of the child themselves without referring a child for evaluation by a psychiatrist or a psychologist. As a result of this, every child that is 10 years or older but under the age of 14 that came into contact with the criminal justice system was referred to a psychologist or a psychiatrist for evaluation in terms of Section 11 of the Act. These children were therefore pathologized and were unnecessarily exposed to the mental system, which is not desirable and not in the best interest of the child. Secondly, there were practical challenges in respect of that, because every child was then referred for evaluation. This resulted in the blocking of the criminal justice system and exacerbated the burden of the health system, in that all these children had to be evaluated by psychiatrists and psychologists. The clauses that deal with the proof of criminal capacities are clauses 7, 15, and 17 in the bill. These clauses amend Section 7, 41, and 49 of the Act to remove a provision that requires a prosecutor or a preliminary inquiry or a presiding officer, when the matter is referred to a child justice court, to consider the criminal capacity of a child when referring a child for diversion. And during when the bill was before the portfolio committee, the portfolio committee proposed a further amendment that if the prosecutor, the inquiry magistrate, or the presiding officer is of the view that it is unlikely that the child would benefit from diversion, then the prosecutor, the inquiry magistrate, or the presiding officer must then refer a child to a probation officer to be dealt with outside the criminal capacity, outside the criminal justice system, to be dealt with as a child who does not have criminal capacity. A further clause that deals with the proof of criminal capacity is the clause 8 of the bill. That clause amends Section 11 of the bill. That section deals with the proof of criminal capacity. So again, in that section, the idea was to remove that requirement that requires the state to prove criminal capacity when the matter is being before the preliminary inquiry. And the criminal capacity the state will only be required to consider and prove criminal capacity when the matter is at the child justice court for plea and trial. Clause 19 amends Section 58 of the Act. Section 58 requires that if the child does not comply with a diversion order, then the matter must go back to a child justice court. Because now criminal capacity would have not been proven if the child was referred for diversion, then this section ensures that if the matter then goes back to the criminal, to the child justice court, the state must prove criminal capacity. Then clause 13, clause 14 and 16 of the Act, clause 18 were inserted to improve the implementation of the Act. This clause deal with a concern that was raised during the research that probation officers are not trained or are not qualified to deal with or to evaluate or to express a view relating to proving a criminal capacity of the child. So the provisions in the Act in section 35G, section 41F and section 43, which require a probation officer to express a view or to include the in the assessment report a recommendation of, on the possibility of proving criminal capacity of a child, are all deleted. And then clause 1, clause 25, and clause 26 in the bill are technical amendments. These deal with the definition of an appropriate adult in the Act. Currently in the Act, appropriate adult is defined to mean a family member, including a sibling that is 16 years or older. But when you look at the definition of a child in terms of the Constitution and in terms of the Children's Act, a child is a person under the age of 18. So it is not correct to say that an appropriate adult would mean a family member who is 16 years or older, because this is a child. So that definition is amended and is substituted with the phrase appropriate person. Clause 18, which is also a clause that is intended to improve the implementation of the Act, substitute the phrase in the Act, which is prima facie case against a child. This was considered to be a very high or strong threshold, which may be, or which the courts are interpreting to mean that all the elements of the crime must be proved, including a criminal capacity. And this has hampered referring children to diversion. So that phrase is substituted with a phrase, prima facie evidence that a child has committed an offense. So this is considered to be less onerous and will facilitate the referring of the children for diversion. Clause 21 of the bill, which is also a clause that is intended to improve the implementation of the bill, amends section 71 of the criminal law, or what is known as the Sexual Offences Act. Section 71 of the Sexual Offences Act requires the court to consider a preliminary report if the court is or is likely to order that the particulars of the child be referred to or be entered into a national register for sex offenders. So clause 71 of the Act is amended to ensure that the Child Justice Court does not dispense with that requirement of a pre-sentence report if it's likely that the court may order that the particulars of a child be entered into a national register for sex offenders. And clause 22 amends section 92 of the Act. That section deals with instances where children are used by adults to commit offences. And as the research found that in some instances young children are used by older children to commit crimes. So the section is amended to substitute the word adult with person, so that will include when a child is being used by another child to commit an offense. And clauses 24, 25, and 26 are also technical amendments relating to the phrase appropriate adult, which is being replaced by the word appropriate person. And these are just technical amendments. And clause 27 is a transitional constitutional arrangements. This is how to deal with legal provisions that are before court now, before the implementation of the scheme when it is enacted into law. And clause 28 is just the short title and the commencement of the scheme. And it provides that the actual time of arrangement at the date that should be proclaimed by the president. And this was necessary to allow subordinate legislation that are made in terms of the text to be amended, because those legislation still refers to a child under the age of 10 years, and the minimum age of criminal capacity has been amended to 12 years. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Deputy Minister. Can we maybe engage with the presentation, or the bill rather, especially in terms of clarity-seeking questions, if there are any, given that we went also through the process yesterday, because, I mean, it's pretty clear in a way. Any follow-up questions or clarity-seeking questions, Honourable Greer? You're okay. Okay, no, thank you. Matt from Gauteng.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm fine, thank you.
Thank you. Deputy Minister, I then propose we go to the cybercrime bill, which is quite a lengthy and technical one.
Maybe just clarity as to how much time we've got. It's now just gone 12. 6 past 12.
I'm not sure how long you think the presentation
will take. Well, the presentation can be tapered according to how long you've got. It's quite a dense bill.
Yes.
I would suggest to Mr. Robertson that he does more of a high-level overview, and there can be more detail later. But I just did want to know, have you got till one, or can it go beyond one?
Yes. Actually, we've got till one, that the Honourable... we had indicated to the department we could also go into the afternoon, but I'm proposing, Deputy Minister, that we just move up to, if we can do the presentation in like 50 minutes, it's quite a lot.
50, 40. Well, look, I would have thought shorter so that there's time for people to ask questions on what they're interested in.
Okay.
They can read up on the stuff. So I don't know, start with it. Try and make it like, I don't know, like 30 minutes.
I'm suggesting we take more time on it because it's quite a technical bill. So it's better if we clarify our understanding in terms of what is probably contained there. But and then, okay, if we can take 30 minutes, it's fine, and then we can do 10 minutes.
We'll see
minutes.
How long it's, what the issues are that people want to raise. I think let Mr. Robertson start. I'll then speak at the end. When in the National Assembly, this bill was, I think, supported by everybody. I'm not entirely sure about EFF. I think it supported. No, it didn't. It didn't support the bill because it opposed the cybersecurity elements, which had already been removed. DA opposed the bill, and I'll go through which areas they opposed and why we don't get any. But can I hand to Mr. Robert?
Thank you, Deputy Minister. Ladies and gentlemen, cybercrime bill, it's a new initiative in South Africa. We tried to more or less rationalize our cyber laws to come in line with international events. Even our neighbor countries, Zimbabwe, Botswana, Algeria, Burundi, and various other countries, is in the process of promulgating cyber legislation to deal with cybercrime. Obviously, cybercrime is your new fast-growing area of crime. Currency is now in digital format. In 2017, Fabric estimated that cybercrime costs South Africa banking around about 250 million in gross losses. In 2018, we ensured that was increased by 64%. But in general, let me tell you, there's really no verifiable statistics about cybercrime in South Africa. if you look at the rest of the world, you will see that people like the United States suffered $9.4 billion in losses in cybercrime. India, $18.5 billion. Mexico, $7.7 billion. UK, $6 billion. And New Zealand, $0.1 billion. And I think South Africa, even at a low scale, we are very close to at least New Zealand's standard. First, our current legislative system does not adequately deal with cybercrime. First, if you want to deal with cybercrime, your substantive criminal law should specifically criminalize conduct as cybercrime. And your procedural laws are mainly there for the collection of evidence. And the Criminal Procedure Act currently cannot be used to investigate cybercrime. Due to the fact that evidence that is required for prosecution of cybercrime is in digital format. It's not an object, something you cannot see. A very important aspect of cybercrime is international cooperation. The reason, therefore, is that cybercrime is not localized to a single country. It usually has a transnational element. A person that commits a cybercrime can sit in Russia, he can run his malware through at least 5 countries, their computer systems, and then attack a victim in South Africa. Our current law of international cooperation is obviously not geared for cybercrime international cooperation. The reason, therefore, is that the evidence you need is transient in nature. It disappears very quickly. So if you follow a formal process, by the time that your letter of request is sent to your foreign country, all that evidence would have been lost. Law of evidence, obviously, there should be certain law that allows for the admissibility of evidence that is in digital format. A further very important aspect relating to cybercrime investigation is obviously the cooperation of service providers, that includes your banking industry, your MTNs, and other cellular providers. They are the persons that own certain networks. They know how their networks operate, and obviously they are there to guide the police in any investigation and to provide assistance. But that said, human rights law is very important in cyberspace. Privacy, constitutional rights in South Africa, something that needs to be protected. Human rights law mainly relates to your procedural aspects, your coercive procedures to collect evidence. This must comply with general human rights standards, like to the rules. And obviously, it's necessary to align a cyber law with international trends and laws of other countries. This is especially relevant for international cooperation. Obviously, you can only provide international cooperation if there's dual criminality, and in most instances also that the sentences that must be imposed is the same. The trend of cybercrime is its involving nature. What is cybercrime and how it's committed today is actually irrelevant tomorrow. It changes frequently. The problem is law enforcement agencies cannot keep up with this frequent changing nature of cybercrime. So in general, you have to involve other people that have got expertise in the relevant field in the investigation of cybercrime. Furthermore, if you look at cybercrime, it's not just cybercrime that's defined in the bill. Various other offences in the statute book may be committed by, let's call it, a cyber intervention. It's like a person can access a hospital's server to switch off substantive apply to a person. And a person die, subsequently murder is committed, and that was committed by cyber means. If you look at South African current law in the static group, first, South African law doesn't comprehensively and uniformly criminalize cyber crime as we know it. If you look at international trends, I must say there's various statutes that do contain cyber crime provisions, like the South African Police Services Act, the Financial Intelligence Center Act, the National Prosecuting Authority Act, but what they did in that legislation is to create certain cyber offences to cater for that government department or agency only. The only real law currently in the statute book that universally caters for cybercrime is the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act, Section 85-89. Obviously, I already indicated current Criminal Procedure Act is totally inadequate to investigate cybercrime. Law for evidence, in general, my submission is adequate to deal with cybercrime. That is also dealt with in the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act, in the first chapter, where they deal with electronic communications. South African Law Reform Commission has, in the interim, completed the report, and that can be used to further review our law of evidence. And already indicated our inadequacy in terms of the International Cooperation of Criminal Matters Act to provide for international cooperation to investigate cybercrime. In broad, the bill criminalized conduct considered a cybercrime. Also criminalized the distribution of a data message which is harmful, and it provides for interim protection orders to protect victims against harm. I believe the Financial Publications Act was recently passed. It was also signed in operation quite, I think, 4 days ago. That act also, to an extent, provides for some malicious communications. I will discuss that later. It also regulates jurisdiction, the bill, to cater for the transnational element of cybercrime. It regulates the powers of police to investigate cybercrime. It also regulates aspects that deals with mutual legal assistance in the investigation of cybercrime. And it established a point of contact in the South African Police Service to nationally facilitate cyber investigations, but also to deal with mutual assistance where other countries is involved. It further to cater for certain evidentiary issues. It provides for the production of evidence by way of affidavit. The bill imposes obligations on electronic communication service providers to report certain cybercrime to the South African Police Service and to keep certain evidence that is in their possession. And importantly, provides for capacity building specifically by the South African Police Service to detect, prevent, and investigate cybercrime. Bill, it's not a silver bullet. You need capacity to investigate cyber crime. Without that capacity, we will go nowhere. Further, it provides that the executive may enter into agreements with foreign countries regarding certain measures to deal with cyber crime. And then the bill also repeals certain provisions on the statute group. Going to go in more detail through the bill. Clause 1.1 of the bill contains various provisions that are applicable to the bill. But also, in certain chapters of the bill, there's separate definitions, and even in certain clauses of the bill, there's definitions that solely relate to the clause in question. Clause 1.2 aims to clarify the application of the Protection of Personal Information Act with certain clauses of the cyber law. Chapter 2 is the main chapter that deals with cyber crime. And first, obviously, I'm not going to go through the general elements of criminal liability, and that's usually comply with the definitional elements of the offence as provided for in the bill, the act must be unlawful, and also a culpability. What I must say is, only intentional act is criminalized. You cannot commit a negligent cyber crime in terms of this bill. And it does not criminalize omission. It must be a real positive act by a person before you commit a cyber crime. Regarding the offences pertaining to cyber crime, they can be broken up in the following main categories. There is offences that is aimed at protecting the confidentiality, integrity, and the availability of the computer systems. And the second category of offences is cyber facilitated offences. That is offences that is similar to some offences that is recognized either in common law by statute that's committed by means of a computer. And the third category of offences is aggravated offences. You can compare it with robbery with aggravated circumstances where enhanced penalties are imposed to protect certain objectives. Your first category of offences is obviously unlawful access. Compare that with housebreaking. If you want to get what's in a computer, you must unlawful access. Similar to a burglar. If you want to steal something from my house, you must access. Unlawful interception, you can compare it to an extent as a category of unlawful access, but the person goes further. In that instance, by technical means, we intercept information that is usually stored in a computer, in a server, whole computer system. Additional offences are created. The first one is that of possession of intercepted data. If it doesn't know that it has been intercepted unlawfully, that's usually in the case where the police arrest a hacker and then on a USB drive they find 1,000 credit card numbers. Okay, how did you come in possession of that credit card number? You can actually say that it's a lucky to he's guilty. The third one is similar to the third offence relating to unlawful interception is the person is under possession of certain data, the person cannot give a reasonable explanation of such possession. That's similar as section 36 and 37 of the General Law Amendment Act, possession of suspected stolen property, etc. Clause 4 aims to criminalise the tools that is used to commit cyber offences. That is your software, nowadays even hardware that can be used to commit that offences. And the possession of that is criminalised if it's possessed for the purpose of committing a criminal offence. Two very important offences are that in clauses 5 and 6. Criminalise unlawful interference on the one hand with data and computer systems, and on the other hand with data storage devices and computer systems. First offence, just want to correct myself, is unlawful interference with data or a computer program. Clause 7 aims to criminalise password related offences. Password related offences very broadly defined in the bill. Password, your credit card number, amongst others, can qualify as a password in terms of that criminalisation. The second category of offences is the offences facilitated by cyber means. First one is cyber fraud. So if a person makes a misrepresentation by means of data, a computer program or through interference with a computer system which causes prejudice to another person, you will then commit cyber fraud. Cyber forgery and hatching is quite similar to our current suspense. It deals with torturing and acting in the real world. It just added a cyber element to that, obviously. The current offense, forgery, is you alter a document. In cyberspace, you don't alter a document, but you alter data or a computer program. And actually, it's really where you send out that forged data or program to somebody else. Cyber extortion is an important criminalization here. Most people probably already experience it. You get the email, tell you to click on the link, and then it tells you your whole hard drive has been encrypted. So you must pay some encrypted currencies, otherwise you'll never get your data. That qualifies as a form of cyber extortion. Okay, aggravated offenses, your third category. First one is that's dealt with by clause 11.1. And that is certain offences that is committed against restricted computer systems, that's banking facilities or state facilities. The second one is that contained in clause 11.2, and that is certain cyber offences which causes serious harm to life and limb and property. What the bill did not do, it did not extend the common law offense of theft in terms of a positive definition or redefining that in terms of the bill. Really plays interpretation clause on that to the court to say, insofar as it relates to theft, the corporal property can be stolen, and that's contained in clause 12 of the bill. Malicious communication, that's contained in part 2 of chapter 2. First one is the distribution of a data message that incites damage to property or violence, that is contained in clause 40. Second one is where a data message is disseminated and where it threatens persons with damage to property or violence. And the third one is a data message that is distributed, which is intimate in nature, and it was distributed without the consent of the victim. Intimate nature is usually where the breast of a woman, the armory of a man, or similar things are exposed. I'll just point out in the schedule to the board. The Sexual Offences Act is also amended to provide for offences relating to harmful distribution of pornography. This is two different offences. The type of conduct or infringement here is relatively not so severe as pornography. Pornography is usually defined in relation to the definition of Sexual Offences Act as either sexual intercourse, masturbation, or even some sexual offences that is provided for in the Sexual Offences Act. Part 3 of Chapter 2, Clause 17, provides for participation in cyber crimes. It's usually the person attempts to conspire, aid, abet, or get the other person to commit an offence. That is currently, in respect of all real world offences, similar clauses apply, and it should also apply to cyber offences. Competent verdicts, that is dealt with in Part 4, Chapter 2. If you look at the Criminal Procedure Act, certain offences, I'll explain competent verdicts. Competent verdicts usually kicks in where a person is charged with one offence, but the elements of that offence is not proved, but the elements of other offence is actually proved in a court of law. Although what can happen is that the prosecutor may pose alternative charges to the main charge, this competent verdict is always available to a court to convict a person. Obviously, there is safeguards. First one is person is unrepresented. It must be brought to his knowledge that he may be found guilty of such a competent verdict. The Criminal Procedure Act, the current competent verdict does not cater for cyber offences. So Part 4, Chapter 2, specifically introduced competent verdicts in respect of cyber offences. Sentencing dealt with in Part 5 of Chapter 2. In general, citizen contravenes Section 2 to 7. Penalties that can be imposed differs from 5 to 7 years of imprisonment, or a fine, or both. The more serious offences, that of cyber fraud, forgery and utterly, and extortion, and one of the aggravated offences. Sentence is in the discretion of the court, but we've seen a schedule to the board. The Minimum Sentences Act has been amended to provide for certain minimum sentences in respect of some of these offences. Intervention of Section 11.1, that's offences against a restricted computer system, punishable with imprisonment for up to 15 years. The sentencing clause further provides for certain aggravated circumstances that must be taken into account. One is, amongst others, that the crime was committed by electronic means. The reason, therefore, is that it's almost impossible to nowadays trace a cyber criminal. On the other hand, such an investigation is extremely expensive. And obviously something that specifically addressed is your insider participation. About 50% of all cyber crimes are committed either by an insider or with the participation of an insider in a business. Part 6 of Chapter 2 deals with protection orders to protect the complainant against malicious communication. This is quite similar to the current Domestic Violence Act protection order, or your protection order in terms of the Protection from Harassment Act, although this order is specifically directed at malicious communication. It differs to some extent. This is an interim order in nature, unlike the Domestic Violence Order or the Protection of Harassment Order. Similar to the DMA and the Protection of Harassment Act, courts may ask an electronic communication service provider for assistance to locate and trace the person who sent the malicious communication. And at the end of proceedings, criminal proceedings, the court can make orders to ensure that this malicious content is either destroyed or that service providers or a person in control of the computer system ensure that nobody can get access to it too. Chapter 3 of the bill, this new clause, clause 24, deals with jurisdiction, expands jurisdiction. The South African law pertains to cybercrime substantially, mainly to cater for the transnational element of cybercrime. Chapter 4 is the chapter that sets out the powers of the police to investigate cybercrime. This chapter must be interpreted to exist in addition to the Criminal Procedure Act, insofar as the Criminal Procedure Act is not in conflict with the provisions of this chapter. Obviously, there's various provisions of the Criminal Procedure Act that is relevant to ordinary criminal investigations, including cybercrime investigation, which will be applicable. In general, if you look at search and seizure in South Africa, the constitutional case of Magiani and other cases, there's extensive safeguards and conditions that have been developed to ensure that the privacy of a person is not infringed. And it's my submission that this chapter complies with all that safeguards that has been pronounced upon. Important provision here is clause 26. It provides for standard operating procedures that must be issued to further regulate the investigation of cybercrime. Standard operating procedures is procedural aspects that will regulate the cyber investigation, and its aim is to protect the integrity of evidence that is collected. Most countries, you can look at the UK, USA, New Zealand, they all have standard operating procedures relating to cyber investigation. It sets out the kind of limited minimum requirements that must be adhered to. In general, a search warrant is necessary to conduct a search and seizure for evidence relating to a cybercrime. That's dealt with in clause 29. Clause 30 provides for oral applications. Obviously, similar to the Criminal Procedure Act, a person who has lawful authority can consent to a warrantless search. That's dealt with in clause 31. Clause 32 and 33 provides for certain circumstances where a police official may seize a computer device or a computer storage device. Both that clauses actually requires a second warrant before a police official can access the contents of the storage medium or the computer system. During this time when we drafted this legislation, the Canadian position was set out in R versus Do. In America, it was Riley versus Summary. They actually require a second warrant for the investigation of cyber content. However, the police has brought it to our attention that there are other jurisdictions that do allow that. And this is probably an aspect that we need to reconsider when we further deal with this law. Further important provision that is made in this chapter is the appointing of investigators to assist the police in the investigation of cyber crime. Like I pointed out previously, law enforcement agency cannot keep track of all the developments in cyber space. So here they can use additional investigators to assist in the investigation. Clause 34 imposes obligations on service providers to assist investigators and South African police in the investigation of cybercrime. I must point out that various clauses in the bill do provide for scope laws to ensure that there is no unnecessary infringement of other rights. Other important provisions in this chapter is probably the provision that relates to expedited preservation of data. It's this clause 42. That is to cater for certain circumstances where there is a need to preserve evidence. But people cannot either intercept it or maybe get a search warrant in time, so they can request a service provider or financial institution to preserve that information. However, judicial authorization is necessary before it can be provided to the South African Police Services. The chapter also clarifies the RICA, this Act, in terms of clause 9 and clause 14. which have the specifically stipulated indirect communication before relating information must be intercepted in terms of the regard. Page 18 of the slideshow, it's chapter 5, mutual assistance. I did already, to a large extent, explain the need for effective mutual assistance in criminal procedures. This chapter merely provides that for such a procedure. It goes a bit further, obviously. I do provide that the South African Police Service may share certain information with other countries relating to a cyber incident. Obviously, most countries don't even know that the computer system has been attacked. It's usually other institutional or other countries that inform them that that has taken place. The chapter sets out the procedure where foreign states request mutual assistance to South Africa, as well as where South Africa requests assistance from a foreign state. Going to expedite this a bit. The point of contact dealt with in chapter 6. Point of contact is a very important mechanism in the whole framework of cyber crime. That is usually a point in each and every country that's available to provide assistance if there is a cyber crime. So they know directly. Contact the SAPS at this email address and request assistance. Similar to South Africa can do that as well. I already explained chapter 9 that deals with evidence. Chapter 9 merely makes provision for a certificate to facilitate the proof of certain cyber elements. Although it's prima facie proof of its content, the court can always call witness and to come and give oral evidence if he deems it in the interest of justice. Chapter 8 imposes supporting obligations, amongst others, on electronic communication service providers regarding cyber offences. It's not each and every cyber offence. Obviously, every person receives at least five incitement to expose this person in particular every day. That should not be reported. The Minister of Police may issue regulations to limit that offences to a certain category of offences, usually more serious offences where there is a loss. What usually happens in South Africa is, and most of the world, companies don't want to report cyber crimes. It's bad for business. So this kind of makes sure that at least there's some compulsion to ensure that there's reporting of some cyber crime. Chapter further provides for obligations of the South African Police to get the necessary capacity to investigate cyber crimes, and the Minister of Police must report to Parliament regarding capacity building initiatives as well as cyber crimes that was reported to the police and which has been investigated and what is the outcome of that investigation. Further imposes similar obligations on the National Prosecuting Authority, which can actually be used as a check and burn to see or verify the information. Chapter also provides for agreements with other countries relating to cyber crime. And in the schedule for the bill, all provisions currently in the statute that criminalise cyber crime is repealed since it's been dealt with in this bill. Further amend the Criminal Procedure Act to further regulate bail in respect of more serious cyber crime and make it a Schedule 5 offence, so the person must substantiate that it's in the interest of justice to release it. Okay, the Criminal Law for the Sexual Offences Act is being amended. as I already said, to deal with harmful disclosure of pornography. And a very important amendment is that the Furniture Publications Act being amended and child pornography is inserted in the sexual offence. That is actually a place where it should have been from the start, and where it belongs. The new clauses that was inserted by the Furniture Publications Amendment Act is very similar to this. It was actually drafted by the same person. The schedule with Child Justice Act is further also amended to provide for a specific sentencing dispensation when minors involved in sexual offences. Thank you.
If I can just add, the bill started its life in as the cyber crime and cyber security bill. The cyber security elements were left behind, because we wanted to actually pass the cybercrime elements, which provide, as Mr. Roberts has said, for the actual crimes and their investigation. So it was removed with the agreement of the then Minister of State Security, and hence it's just the cybercrime bill. I think it is relatively non-controversial. However, the Democratic Alliance, just for the benefit of the members and the committee, when the Portfolio Committee was finalizing the bill, they raised two amendments. The one was that you can seize an item without a warrant, if a hard drive without a warrant, if in the time it takes you to get the warrant, the evidence will be removed. There was also a provision that you could access that hard drive without a warrant if in the time it took you to get the warrant. The DA opposed that. We did agree to that. However, we are having second thoughts, and the police are also having second thoughts on that. The issue basically would be, although you've got the hard drive, you can still access it, access that hard drive and wipe everything out. The police have referred to an issue of there's a robbery or murder or something, that the person leaves their cell phone behind. You want to be able to access that cell phone immediately to find out more information around where they're going. Currently, in terms of the DA amendment, you can't. So that amendment is in the bill that was passed by the National Assembly. However, we are wanting, and the police are wanting, that to be relooked at. The other DA issue was that with this point of contact, this provision which is set up by the police, and it's meant to be a place where people come with international requests and so on, this provision that the Minister of Police must report to the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence, which, as members would know, is you have to have security clearance, its meetings are not public. And the DA wanted us to say it must be to Parliament, it must be open. We refused that, and the Portfolio Committee refused that amendment. Both these amendments did not come from public hearings, and there was, I think, no comment on them, except to the Honourable Seleko. There was a comment on the DA amendment that we refused on the point of contact, and that was that this section is wonderful and needs to be kept. That comment came from the Premier of the Western Cape, Honourable Seleko, and the one that the Institute of Race Relations wants to be your leader. So I'm just sort of saying, I'm just scared, scoring some points, 2 points. I'm saying, even from the DA's side, there wasn't. I don't know how. I think it was other politics. I think it was other politics, basically. But basically, that's the background of the bill. It's a 75 bill. I understand it was put out for public comment. And just to correct, the Child Justice was as well. I see Gershwin is over that side. But it's a Section 75 bill, so it is effectively a party vote, and you need to decide given that, what you do with it, whether you go and advertise further for public comment or not. But I think this general, as I understand it, apart from these two DA amendments, which the DA, honourable DA members needs to find out what the problems were, I think there's general consensus on the bill.
Thank you, Deputy Minister and Mr. Robertson. Thank you very much for the presentation. Unfortunately, Deputy Minister, your last comments are going to take comments in a different direction. But be that as it may, our members, if you can maybe just ask clarity-seeking questions in terms of the bill itself as presented. Thank you. Honourable Kalakis, is there any other member? Ma'am Nita? Okay, it's just the two.
Thank you very much, Chair. I have to say that I make no objection to the Deputy Minister scoring cheap points. Even the ANC need to feel how it feels like every now and again, even if it's cheap points in this case. I'm sure you had 9 years of drought in that department in terms of scoring any political points. So I'll give you that. How's that for a cheap win? Listen, I just have a few concerns, apart from the ones that the Minister raised with regards to state security, which it's a view that I share with my colleagues in the National Assembly. But I just want you to ask your views in terms of the example that you mentioned with regards to the warrant. You mentioned the police said, well, if they're waiting for a warrant, you can wipe everything off. I have an iPhone and a MacBook. If you take my cell phone or it gets stolen, I immediately lock it through my MacBook. So that doesn't really serve any purpose in that regard. So I don't think it's a very good example for the police to use. That's just a comment in the passing. But my main concern, and this is a real concern, is that in the recent past we've seen examples of people who have claimed to and proven to be spied on by the state. And this is a real concern. If this bill gets passed, the South African government would be in violation of many of these sections as well. How does this, as well as the recent RICA judgment, affect that? I might be wrong. I see that heads are being shaken. I would just like some clarity on this specifically, please. Then the point that concerns me even more is lack of capacity of the police. Now, I know it's not your department, but I have asked, and it was mentioned earlier as well, I have asked questions over the last 2 years to the police as to the specialized unit within the police's capacity. They indicate every year that they're going to ask Treasury for more money, but more money is not forthcoming. My big concern, and again I say it's not within your department, but surely that must be discussed on cabinet or at cabinet level, is if over the last 2 years Treasury hasn't shown the willingness to actually capacitate the police to the extent that they actually need for this to be enforced, then it's going to be a piece of law on paper, but it's not going to have any effect. Is there any discussions around that going on to make sure that when it actually gets passed that it is fully enforceable? And what is what are we talking about in terms of capacity that the police will need in addition to what they already have to make that possible? Because it's not going to be a very cheap exercise, although it is very necessary. I also do think, and it's not so much pertaining to the bill itself, but I do think you as a department or as the government as a whole should perhaps also consider having a public awareness campaign around these issues, because a lot of the time you can't actually pick up who the culprit was. The best way to make sure that the occurrence of these crimes go down is actually if people are taught how to go about with their own information in the first place. And that's just a comment that I think the government should consider very seriously. You have spoken about the point of contact issue that I have, and then there's just a last question that I also have, and that is with regards to grey hat hackers, which are people who without authority but with good intentions hack someone and then indicate to them there's this flaw in your security and it could have been breached. They would obviously be affected by some of the provisions in this law. Have you considered that? Because I know of cases where indeed such hackers have, with good intentions but without authority, hacked businesses and government departments and so on, and then went on to tell them, be careful of this, be careful of that. So in general, they're good guys. But they're going to find their hands tied in most cases. Has that been considered? And what is your position and your views on that? Thank you.
That's a business transaction. But anyway, Nida.
Thank you. First, let me welcome the presentation. And I must also say, in my view, it's long overdue. It's really a progressive move from the department to start talking about this particular bill. I want also to start on what he has touched on first, the issue of RICAR, because it is also mentioned in your presentation. It's true that there is a judgment on that one. Just for the purpose of educating myself, Honorable Deputy Minister, when there is a judgment by the High Court or any other court, what is then becomes the role of the department to ensure that judgment is adhered to, even by the service provider? I'm asking this question because I went to MTN, I wanted to buy a SIM card, and I was told to bring my address, a home where I live, and in my mind I had the issue that there is a judgment to that effect, and how does it get implemented across that, that for interest sake from that. The question, you touched on it, both the Deputy Minister as well as the presenter, the issue of capacity for those that would be required to implement the bill and as well monitor the bill. I'm thinking about the investigative task and judicial system itself. How do you make sure that they are capacitated enough to deal with the criminals in the issue of cyberspace? And the other one, you also spoke of cooperating with some service providers. In providers in crucial and very essential information. And now, immediately in my mind, I have this thing, how are you going to make sure that those service providers that you deal with, they are properly screened, such that you are not using the same people that are linked to the crime that we are trying our best to curb as government. So those are my questions. Also the issue of child. You have also touched on the issue of Child Justice Act. And when you were presenting, in my mind, I said, this bill is going to be crucial for implementation and public awareness, because most of the people that are very learned in one way or another is young people on issues of technology. They may do things unaware that those are criminal acts that they are doing. So there's also an element of awareness raising to those that are still young to understand when they do this, this is a crime, this is not a crime. I'm just thinking aloud on that one. Thank you.
Thank you. Deputy Minister, maybe just another question around Clause 54. terms of why the South African Reserve Bank and the financial sector regulator are exempted from reporting cybercrime when they become aware of it, because of reporting such cybercrime to staff. But the second one is in terms of the RICA issue. What is the effect of the High Court judgment on provisions of the bill during this year?
Let me start with Mr. Robertson and then add. Just on RICA, I mean, RICA provides for interception, regulation of interception of communications. And this bill does not. Okay, so there's a separation between the two. The status of RICA is that sections have been found to be unconstitutional. It then has to be confirmed by the High Court, by the Constitutional Court. And so that judgment is not in effect as yet. I think some of the ministers may be appealing, so it's an issue of will there be an appeal, but even if there's no appeal, it has to be confirmed by the High Court, sorry, by the Constitutional Court. We have learned, we are in the process of amending RICA, but we've learned, and you'll get the bill later, that with the bill, with a High Court judgment relating to prescription of certain sexual offences, once the court gave that judgment, we started an amendment bill, which we in fact brought to Parliament before the declaration was confirmed by the Constitutional Court. The Constitutional Court, when it heard the matter, actually then wanted additional sections included. So we had to withdraw that bill. So we've rather learnt, rather don't bring bills before the whole process is completed. That's the sort of short on that. But basically, we don't see, I mean, Mr. Robertson can confirm it, so there is an amendment, there are some amendments in the schedule to RICA, but this cybercrime bill is not dealing with interception at all. Just on the point of the DA clause that went in, I think we would be probably bringing a proposed amendment to the committee. It's precisely for that issue, Mr. Michalakis, that you know, your cell phone gets seized in a without a warrant because you'll remove it, destroy it, whatever, to stop you from being able to then access your cell phone through your iPad and wiping everything clean. I think we won't be going back to what we had before, but we would still be allowing it, but subject to some checks and balances. That's the proposal we would be making, but we can come to that. The capacity of the police issue, look, as Mr. Roberts has said, there is provision for, under Chapter 4, the powers to investigate, for an investigator who's not a member of the police, but who has been identified and authorized in terms of the search warrant to assist the police. So the police, this is not just capacity issues, it's because of the speed at which the information, the technology is moving. You might find an expert and the police say, we want to use this person to help us with our search for material. That person then has to be named, either named in the warrant that they get from the magistrate, or requested by a police official in terms of sections of this act. So that's sort of one area. I think a lot of Mr. Robertson may be able to add, but look, this bill will make it easier to, not addressing the capacity problems, it sets out the crimes clearer, and it sets out the procedures to be followed, like searches and stuff like that. How do you search in cyberspace when the Criminal Procedure Act involves searching and looking for hard objects like this bottle of water, but information on the hard drive or in the iCloud, how does that work? I think Mr. Robertson can specifically talk about I think this Lisa's point of the relationship with service providers, I haven't addressed that. The grey hat searches, I mean, hey, I mean, I'm sure, look, if some guy breaks into your house and then comes to you or leaves you a note saying, look, I broke into your house, but your electricity is up the wall, you must really have your house rewired. Is it not going to be the same reaction? I would have thought that. You know, very nice of them, you know, but they've broken into your house. So they've broken into your computer system. And I think, as the chair had said, are they doing it from such a good motive, or are they more wanting to say, you need me and you need to pay me to fix all your problems? But Mr. Robertson can look, there is the issue of intention, but he can explain that more. 55 for the Reserve Bank and the exemption, I'll leave you to do that one. Yeah.
Okay. Deputy Minister, first, the grey hat hackers. Usually what happens, it's called the bug bounty. Some people will say, I've got a security system in place, person who hacks it can collect a bug bounty. Okay, but what usually happens is people hack into high security places, leave some software behind, inform the people the system is really not up to standard, and you know, the problem is the intention by which it's committed. It's the same as each and every other crime. It must be criminalized, otherwise there's going to be gaps that's going to be exploited by criminals. There's no way around it. Really, I can tell you that. We did consider this. I believe the research that was done on this ran into something like 28 pages. No foreign country to recognize this. It's something, you either put it out as a bug bounty, or you can't just pay the bounty due to the fact your reputation has maybe affected. Like the Deputy Minister said, RICOS does not apply yet. 29.1 is excluded from search and seizure, as well as Section 41 of the Act. Public awareness campaigns regarding the bill and cyber security in general. There is currently a structure in place at the Department of Telecommunication and Postal Service. It's a cyber security hub, which actually has a website that's running. We provide information about the bill, about cybercrime. They do certain roadshows, go to schools, teach pupils about cybersecurity, etc. It's a start. No country in the world has come to terms with cybercrime or cybersecurity. Let me tell you that. Regarding the Reserve Bank and the other structure, that is excluded from the reporting requirement. The financial regulator or the Reserve Bank. We were requested to exclude them, but first, I believe the South African Reserve Bank, if you look at it, 26 legislation, is not ipso facto a bank, it's an administrator. In terms of the Twin Peaks legislation, sector regulator is not a bank, it's an administrator. They won't be in possession of systems with valuable digital data, etc. But let me tell you, I'll come back on that one, and that was why we excluded it. I'll give you the specific reason on that one. Regarding the service providers, the reporting obligation, you are concerned about security. Security here is...
Where does cooperation with the land?
Is this in terms of the where you need to inform the police? That's what you refer to, man. Okay, the bill places obligation on certain, let's call them businesses. In this regard, it's a financial institution or electronic communication service provider. that sentence of section 51, assist 541. What happens is, in terms of the bill, let's say the Minister of Police determined each and every fraud above 10,000 rand must be reported by the must be reported to the South African Police Service. Each and every service provider or financial institution that was subject to such a crime must report that to the South African Police Services as a start. That's in terms of a statutory obligation. Second obligation on them is they must preserve information relating to the offence. Now, usually in the banking industry, and as far as it relates to electronic communication service providers, they've got their own high security teams that deals with system security. They are actually people that has got the necessary security clearance. So I will not actually be concerned about any security clearance. But it's mainly a statutory obligation that that's imposed on them. I don't think the issue of security actually do come into place. But you did raise your RICA registration requirement in terms of section 40 of RICA, where you have to take your name and address and ID book to the service provider, which must then be stored. And your concern probably relates to security or further distribution of that information. The Protection of Personal Information Act can take care of that on the one hand. In terms of section 40 of the RICA, there is obviously also regulations that may be issued to further regulate how must this information be dealt with. No regulation has been made, but look, I really do receive at least two calls a day of people that say they RICA'd and then they receive the call from that company and that company. How did my information got in their possession? In most instances, it's really not information that's leaked from the RICA database. Just look in your daily, what you do. You go to a shop. Most instances, if you apply for credit, you provide your cell numbers. You send it out to your cell number to a lot of other people. Mostly in that instances where it is further distributed. And something else that maybe considered as a concern is that there is actually a database on the internet with all your contact details currently, which is kept by business. Did I miss anything?
Yeah. Maybe just in the Protection of Personal Information Act for PIA deals with personal information and what you can keep and what you can't. And that is in the process of coming into effect as the information regulator gets established. And so I think a lot of those databases would fall foul of that act.
And maybe just on capacity building, since the bill, since the development of the bill, there was cooperation amongst others with other countries regarding capacity building. I think the judiciary actually did receive and worked out a full program on how to deal with cybercrime matters and how to evaluate virtual evidence. Justice College is one of the facilities that provide training to prosecutors. A similar system has been implemented since last year to further train prosecutors. The National Prosecuting Authority has also actually sponsored certain prosecutors to qualify further in the post-grad qualifications relating to cybercrime investigation or in general cybercrime. So we didn't stand still, really. We did try to move. At least we judiciary can give effect to this act. Prosecutors can prosecute this act. At least there's a cyber app which was really established with meager funds, but it's up and running.
I think as soon as the bill is passed, I think this will increase. Thank you.
Thank you, Deputy Minister and your team, for the three briefings. I think they were quite comprehensive, and I'm sure in terms of our understanding of the three bills, I'm sure we're at a better position now. Thank you, and thank you, honourable members, for attending this session. I think we're well in time, and let me then just declare this meeting closed. Before, let me also thank our support staff. I think, Deputy Minister, we also have a second committee secretary here, and it's Zolani. Okay. Thank you, everybody. This meeting's closed.